Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Geoffrey Matthews reads the 7th of 10 episodes.
After some weeks in Shangri-La, Conway was summoned before the incredibly aged High Lama, who described how the Lamasery was rebuilt as a Christian monastery in 1734 by a middle-aged monk called Father Peru.
"What is it that you guess after my long story?" said the High Lama. "What is it that you believe, my son?"
"I believe," said Conway. "I believe that you are still alive, Father Peru." The High Lama said nothing, but bowed his head. A moment later he gave an imperceptible signal with his hand, and a servant padded in with bowls of tea. Conway didn't wonder at his call for refreshment, for the strain of such a long recital must have been considerable. When the bowls had been cleared away, Conway said, "So, you intend to keep us here, Father?"
"You have guessed correctly, my son."
"What puzzles me is why we four, out of all the rest of the world's inhabitants, should have been chosen."
"It is an intricate story. You must know that we have always aimed as far as possible to keep up our numbers. Unfortunately, since the recent war, travel and exploration in Tibet have been almost completely held up. In fact, our last visitor arrived in 1912 and was not, to be candid, a very valuable acquisition. A few years ago, however, one of our number came to the rescue with a novel idea, to bring us additional colleagues by a method which would have been impossible in an earlier age."
"You mean," said Conway, "that he was sent out deliberately to bring somebody back by air?"
"He was a resourceful youth, and we had great confidence in him. It was his own idea, and we allowed him a free hand in carrying it out. All that we knew definitely was that the first stage of his plan included a period of tuition at an American flying school."
"Yes, I see," said Conway. "But the biggest question of all I have left unasked until now. I have heard with interest all you have said about the foundation of this establishment, about the need for recruitment, about the methods that you've used, but perhaps now you'll tell me. What is the idea behind it all?"
My son, I will be happy to impart to you the secret of Shangri-La. All I ask is that what I tell you now shall remain for the present unknown to your three companions. Now, we do not follow an idle experiment here at Shangri-La. We have a dream and a vision. It is a vision that first appeared to me when I lay dying, as I believed, here in this very room, almost a century and a half ago. I looked back on what was then already a long life, and it seemed to me that war, greed, brutality might someday crush and obliterate the things that really matter. I saw nations more and more determined to destroy, and I believed that when they'd filled the land and the sea with ruin, they would take to the air. Can you say that my vision was untrue?"
"No, indeed no," said Conway. "Your vision was true."
"But that was not all. It seemed there would come a time when men would rage so hotly over the world that every precious thing would be in danger, every book, picture, every treasure garnered through the ages, all would be lost."
Conway thought of the world he had left behind him, the tensions, the dangers, the fears. "I think you may be right," he said. "I think you may be right."
"Believe me, my son, that vision will come true. I say it in sorrow, and that is why I am here and why you are here, and why we may pray to outlive the doom that gathers round us on every side.
To outlive it?
Yes, my son, for you there is a chance.
You think Shangri-La will escape?
Oh, perhaps, my son, perhaps. We may expect no mercy, but we may hope for neglect. Here we shall stay with our books and our music and our meditations. We have a heritage to cherish and bequeath. And then, my son, when the strong have devoured each other, the Christian ethic may at last be fulfilled, and the meek shall inherit the earth.
The old man's voice ended, and for a long time Conway remained seated amid the shadows as if in a trance. He never remembered how he took his leave. It was like a dream from which he didn't emerge until long afterwards. He only remembered the night air, icy after the heat of those upper rooms, and sensed Chang's presence as they crossed the starlit courtyards. Never had Shangri-La offered more concentrated loveliness to his eyes. Chang did not speak, and neither did he. It was very late, and he was glad that all the others had gone to bed. In the morning, he wondered if everything that he could call to mind were part of a waking or sleeping vision. But he was soon reminded. A chorus of questions greeted him when he appeared at breakfast.
"Ah, you certainly had a long talk with the boss last night," said Barnard. "We meant to wait up for you, but we got tired. Huh. What kind of a guy is he?"
"Did he say anything about the porters?" said Mallinson. I hope you mentioned to him about having a missionary stationed here," said Miss Brinklow.
I'm afraid I'm probably going to disappoint you all. I did not discuss with him the question of missions. He didn't mention the porters to me at all. As for his appearance, I can only say he's a very old man who speaks excellent English and is very intelligent.
Do you think he means to let us down?"
"Well, he didn't strike me as a dishonourable person."
"Why on earth didn't you worry him about the porters, then?"
"To be quite honest, Mallinson, it didn't occur to me." Mallinson stared at him.
"What's going on here? That's what I want to know. I just can't face all this mystery. That Chinese girl, Lo Tsen, for instance, how did she get here? Did the fellow tell you that?"
"No. Why should he?"
"Well, why shouldn't he? And why didn't you ask?"
"Well, I don't reckon you folks will value my opinion any," said Barnard. "But since we gotta be here for some time yet, let's keep our tempers, huh? And make yourselves comfortable."
"Oh, yes," said Mallinson. "I can quite believe you find it more comfortable here than in Sing Sing."
Now, of course, Chang talked to Conway completely without reserve.
"Chang, how about the process of retarding age?"
"It is partly a natural process occasioned by the atmosphere of the valley. I am now 97. If I remained away from the valley for more than a very few days, I should die. Even if I had left some 30 years ago, when I had the appearance of a man of 30, I should very quickly have acquired the look of my actual age."
"That's rather grim, Chang. It gives one the feeling that time is like some monster waiting outside the valley to pounce on those who have managed to evade him longer than they should."
During the course of a week or so after the interview with the High Lama, Conway met several other members of the Lamasery and enjoyed his first talk with Alphonse Briac, a wiry, small-statured Frenchman who didn't look especially old, though he announced himself as having been a pupil of Chopin, who had died in 1849. As the days drifted into weeks, Conway was discovering happiness. When he sat playing Chopin in the music room, he often felt a peace that he had never known before.
he would sometimes listen to Lo Tsen playing some intricate fugue on the harpsichord. She talked very little, even though she now knew that Conway could speak her language. With Mallinson, who liked to visit the music room sometimes, she was almost dumb. Once, Conway asked Chang about her. He learned she came of royal Manchu stock.
She was betrothed to a prince of Turkestan and was traveling to meet him when her carriers lost their way in the mountains.
And when did this happen?
In 1884. She was 18.
But she looks no more than 30 now.
If that.
Once he asked Chang when he could expect to see the High Lama again.
Oh, doubtless at the end of your first 5 years, my dear sir,
was the answer. But in that confident prophecy, Chang was wrong. For less than a month after his arrival at Shangri-La, Conway received a second summons to that torrid upper room. Chang had told him that the High Lama never left his apartment, and that their heated atmosphere was necessary for his bodily existence. Conway, being prepared, found the change of temperature less disconcerting than before. As soon as he had made his bow and received a faint response, he breathed more easily. He and the High Lama exchanged all the usual courtesies, and Conway answered the many polite questions. He said he was finding the life very agreeable, and had already made friendships.
And you have kept our secrets from your three companions. Chang has told me about them. The lady, Miss Brinklow. He says she is eager to stay and preach in the valley.
Yes, that is so. She has spent many years as a missionary in China, and she believes that Providence has guided her to Shangri-La. She has decided to answer the call. It seems she has certainly taken up the study of the language as a first step.
And the American Barnard, Chang tells me that he, too, is quite settled.
His motives may be questionable, but he has certainly accepted the situation with cheerfulness. I don't believe he would leave the valley now, even if he were offered the opportunity.
And so we come to the third member of your party. I speak of Mr. Mallinson.
Well, Mallinson's an excitable youth. He's pretty keen to get home.
I know of Mr. Mallinson and of what passes in his mind. It is on his account that I have asked you to come here. I want to warn you. Mr. Mallinson can endanger everything we hold precious here at Shangri-La. Be on your guard against that young man, day and night.
That was Episode 7 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton. It was read by Jeffrey Matthews.